Hello and welcome to Truth News Radio Australia on the 30th of October 2010. My name is Hereward Fenton and this is an Australian-made broadcast which gets around the world a bit. We focus on a lot of issues relevant to Australians, but we also cover things that are global in extent. And this morning, just breaking on the news wires, we've got one of those global stories. Explosive packages spark security scare. US President Barack Obama has confirmed that suspect packages from Yemen flights bound for the United States contained explosive material, describing the security scare as a credible terrorist threat. Well, as you might guess, this sort of thing doesn't really strike us as very real. But it is real in the sense that it is being parroted on the news over and over again. I've heard it on the news at least, 10 times while I had the radio on this morning. And that'll be going on all over the world as we speak. And this is the pattern that we've seen ever since September 11, 2001. And quite often these scares are nothing. And this looks like a totally nothing one. Quite often they're exaggerated, like the underpants bomber. But what we see, the pattern here, I believe, is just it's a continuous reinforcement of the terror meme, the threat meme to trigger public response, to enable government and military procedures and policies to be implemented. And I mean, when the underpants bomber struck in late 2009, I believe it was, immediately on the wake of that, we had news of rollouts of the naked body scanners everywhere. And of course, the underpants bomber didn't really cause too much death and carnage, certainly very little in comparison to the regular numbers of people that are killed by troops, our troops, Australian and US, in Afghanistan, which is a country, of course, that we invaded and we now occupy with military force, and a country where vast amounts of illegal opium is being grown completely under the noses of the foreign occupying soldiers. So, yes, security alerts are in place at airports in Britain and the United States, where the authorities are examining suspicious packages on cargo planes en route from Yemen. A suspicious parcel was found at the UK's East Midlands Airport on a plane which originated in Yemen and was bound for Chicago. And we had Barack Obama himself, the president himself, coming on television to tell us and to scare us. Woo, be afraid, the boogeyman's there, the boogeyman's gonna get ya, he's coming back, trust us, hand over power to us, let us protect you. And I've listened to some quite ridiculous interviews with anti-terrorism experts who obviously have no information about this at all, opining on what is going on, and really, they are opining, folks. There's just nothing to this. It's the most really, really sad and pathetic story within the whole string of sad and pathetic stories related to the war on terror. Okay, just moving on with some Australian topics now. Just want to revisit the Kevin Bracken affair. We've had a lot of interesting developments since that over the last week or so. We had a poll on the Sun Herald, which was basically showing 75% of people in favor of Kevin Bracken's statement that the 9/11 attacks official explanation did not stand up to scientific scrutiny. And Kevin Bracken, of course, is a trade union leader, president of the Trades Hall Council, and an influential spokesperson for working Australians, and a leader. Now, we had the attacks on Kevin Bracken in the news, and we also had attacks from leading politicians. I've got here a really nice compilation of that from Anthony Lawson, who's a well-known truth commentator who lives actually in Thailand, but he has a strong background in television voiceovers, and he has a really excellent voice. And he's actually done a presentation here, which I'll just play to you, basically summarizing the series of events which happened with Kevin Bracken coming onto the, you know, the public stage. So I'll just play that to you right now.
On Wednesday, October 20th, Kevin Bracken put the cat among the pigeons when he told John Fain on an Australian Broadcasting Commission radio chat show that he was among the growing number of people in Australia, and indeed the world, who do not believe the official 9/11 story.
I sent out an email last night in relation to the debate on Afghanistan, is that what we should be doing is calling for a proper investigation into the events of September 11, that there's so many unanswered questions, and that the official story doesn't stand up to scientific scrutiny.
Hello?
Yes, mate, sorry.
What's your surname?
Kevin Bracken.
From the
Victorian Branch Secretary of the Maritime Union and the President of the Victorian Trades Hall Council.
And are you a believer in the conspiracy theories about the collapse of the World Trade Centre?
Well, I believe that the official story is a conspiracy theory that doesn't stand up to scientific scrutiny.
Are you serious?
It needs to be.
Is this a hoax, or are you serious?
Sorry to interrupt, but please take note of the way that the host of this publicly funded program treats a guest who has a genuine concern.
No, and I'd love to debate you on it publicly, John, if you'd like, and if you think it's ridiculous.
There's nothing to debate,
Kevin. I'll challenge it to a public to debate.
There's nothing to debate.
The fact is that aviation fuel doesn't get hot enough to melt steel, and no high-rise steel frame building before or after September 11 has ever collapsed.
So, Kevin, what...
Quite apart from his rude interruption, John Fain's next question is irrelevant, because Kevin Bracken was trying to make a point about the science of the offence, not who may have been responsible.
Kevin, which version of the conspiracy theories do you subscribe to for the alternative?
Well,
are you saying that the Israelis engineered it, or do you believe that there's the Bilderberg group, or which version of the nutter conspiracies is the one you subscribe to?
No, I stick to scientific facts.
Yeah, go on, but which one?
And the facts are that aviation fuel doesn't get hot enough to melt steel.
So what did happen that day? In your mind, what did happen on that day?
In my mind,
yeah.
The buildings were imploded.
And instead of addressing the issues, John Fain indulges in an unwarranted ad hominem attack.
And you're the Secretary of the Maritime Union, and you're on the Trades Hall Council Executive.
I'm the President of the Victorian Trades Hall Council, and we've taken resolutions from both.
I think
those.
It reflects very poorly on your members, Kevin, that you have views that are so ridiculous, so extreme, and so unacceptable, and yet you hold office in some of our unions in Victoria.
I'd love to, if it's so ridiculous, John,
it
I'd
is.
Challenge you to debate me.
Unequivocally. Unequivocally, I'm astonished, because this is the lunatic fringe. This is the extreme right or the loony left coming together around the back of the shed to believe in absurd nonsense, and you ought to be in a position to see it for what it is, but you don't.
And the trouble is, mate, blokes like you are keeping most of the people in the dark in this country.
Yeah, well, that's like the Tea Party rubbish too.
Why don't you debate me on it, John?
I'm happy to. Go on. Whatever ridiculous... I get these emails kind of two or three a day, and quite frankly...
So, by his own admission, this isn't new to Mr. Fain, but he still has not addressed one point that Mr. Bracken has raised.
I'll just leave it there. It goes on for another 6 minutes or so, and really summarises the whole debacle beautifully, and also provides the initial interactions there, which we didn't hear last week, and demonstrates that when Kevin Bracken introduced himself, he didn't lead as, you know, the president of the Trades Hall Council. This was actually prompted by John Fain. And of course, he had been in touch with John Fain before and had been asked to call in. So some of the claims that John Fain have made has made are clearly inaccurate. And the whole tone of John Fain in response to Kevin Bracken, as you can see, is to vilify, to ridicule. And of course, this style of behavior is completely in breach of the ABC's charter. And I believe that we should be mounting a campaign to have John Fain sacked, simply based on that. Because it is against the charter, he has violated the principles, and based on the poll that was conducted in the Sun Herald, we see that, in fact, his is the minority view. It may be the view that is held by many people who are rich and powerful in our society, but it is actually the minority view now. And we are, allegedly, last I heard, we were a democracy, and it is not simply the prerogative of the rich and powerful to determine what is acceptable, what is acceptable discourse, and what the truth is. Because many of the people who are questioning 9/11 are questioning from a solid scientific background, far stronger than John Fain. John Fain has a degree in law, so he should at least have some concept of how to argue and how to evaluate logical argument. But he appears not to even have that. So we need a campaign, and this will be a continuous feature of our broadcasts. And I should just point out, it's come to my attention that Alex Jones interviewed Kevin Bracken just last night. That'll be on the 29th or the 30th of October from the Alex Jones Show. So I'll be digging up those archives as well at some point in the future. But I encourage you to visit prisonplanet.com and have a listen to the interview with Alex Jones. I'm sure that'll be extremely interesting. Invasion of Pakistan is imminent, says Qatar. The US will invade Pakistan to deal with instability, and Australia must send troops there too, says independent MP Bob Qatar. This is a story from October the 26th. Mr. Qatar told Parliament the situation in Pakistan was increasing the likelihood of a US invasion, which Australia should support. Yeah. Okay, Bob. Well, look, that is the most outrageous, ludicrous, and disappointing thing I've ever heard coming from an independent MP. And honestly, disappointment is the main feeling that I have in response to that, because I had thought that that Bob Qatar and some of these other independents were actually putting a bit of common sense and a bit of decency back into the political debate. But, you know, clearly I'm wrong. The situation in our parliament is so appalling at the moment. We have no real opposition. We have no effective opposition. We have weak opposition from the Greens, who, of course, support the outlandish plans for a carbon tax, while at the same time weakly opposing Australia's military involvement. We have weak opposition to the government's plans for internet censorship. You know, we've got much more grassroots support for that, for opposing that, but we don't really have a clear plan in case of the government proceeding with the internet censorship, which is actually going to be extremely draconian. We have a government moving more and more unilaterally to basically take over the control of infrastructure. The National Broadband Network, which is currently the subject of vigorous debate in Parliament, is actually a plan for the government to more or less take over the internet infrastructure of Australia. And given that that they actually also have plans to censor the internet, this is something to be extremely concerned about. And on a similar note, I'm just going to move on to another story here. Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth is to be included in the school curriculum. And this again reflects on the tendency of our government to become, it's really the corporate corporatist model of control, because as we know, the carbon trading program and Al Gore himself is closely tied with big business. Huge amounts of investment have gone into carbon credits and carbon trading programs. Al Gore in particular is going to benefit hugely from this financially. And of course, the film An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore has massive numbers of inaccuracies in it. And a court actually found in 2007, I believe, that in the UK, that the film was a propaganda film. This was based on a campaign led by some parents who were concerned about this, and a court found that the film actually was promoting political propaganda. And if it was to be screened in schools, it had to be balanced, and some of the errors needed to be actually noted. It is not primarily a scientific film. It is primarily a political film. Nonetheless, the climate change documentary will be included in the national curriculum as part of a bid to educate students on environmental sustainability. It would be the first time the film, which follows former US Vice President Al Gore's climate change campaign, has been included in the school English curriculum. Notice they've put it in the English curriculum, which I think is an indication of what this film really is and what it is not. Education ministers agreed 2 years ago that a focus on environmental sustainability would be included across the curriculum. Notice as well that they're using the phrase environmental sustainability. Why do you think they're actually using that phrase now? Because the language of the debate is starting to shift. And I'm going to move on to discuss that in more depth, but I just want to point out in this article, and you can find this on our show notes, there is actually a poll which asks the question, should the Al Gore climate film An Inconvenient Truth be included on the national curriculum? And we have total votes, 1,266. Of that, 84.2% say absolutely not. 84.2%, ladies and gentlemen, say absolutely not. Again, here is the government acting unilaterally to basically enforce a view of reality, which actually entails very real and painful costs to the individual, which they're going to enforce through government policy and taxes. And they're doing this in the face of 84% of the people who responded to a random poll in one of the leading newspapers in the country say absolutely not. So again, we see the pattern and we just keep repeating it. It gets monotonous, but then, you know, the government propaganda gets monotonous too. And we will monotonously bat back the monotonous, stupid propaganda that comes from government. Right, now just continuing with our theme of environmental madness and carbon silliness. Carbon trading project, a world first. A world first trial of a personal carbon trading scheme that will also target obesity is to be conducted by the Southern Cross University on Norfolk Island. The 3-year project will involve giving everyone on the island a card loaded with carbon units, according to the man leading it, Gary Egger. Every time they go and pay for their petrol or their power, and from the second year their food, it will not only be paid for in money, but it will also come off the carbon units they are given for free at the start of the program. If people are thrifty and don't buy a lot of petrol or power or fatty foods, they'll have units to spare, which they can cash in at the bank. Now, this has been conducted on Norfolk Island, which is a very remote, very isolated community, and has had a lot of strange you know, it's been known to be a rather eccentric place, and there's been a lot of odd scandals over the years which have popped up there to do with, you know, deviant sexual behavior and stuff. But, you know, a perfect little microcosm to test out something that the climate Nazis would just love to roll out globally. A card, a credit card that basically keeps a track of your carbon footprint. And, you know, once you've used up all your carbon, or your free carbon points, you know, it starts to get expensive, or maybe they just block you and you can't do certain things that you'd like to do. Now, this gets back to this concept that I was mentioning earlier, that the climate change debate has actually shifted more and more into a debate about sustainability and population. And while the science around climate is starting to become more and more unstable, because the skeptics are actually starting to demonstrate that the global warming claims specifically haven't been proven and the science was unsound, the environmentalists, who were only using global warming as a scare tactic anyway, are actually moving forward with other scare tactics which will have the same effect anyway. And I think we're going to see this more and more over time. We're going to see that there's a shift towards this sustainability issues over population issues, while they continue to roll out the same agenda and continue to talk about carbon as being the problem. But of course, carbon is life. Carbon is us. And the question of whether it's carbon dioxide or whether it's just, you know, people being a nuisance who need to be basically removed from the planet can certainly be played with by the people who want to bring these policies in. Now, look, I'm going to break at this point because we have an interview coming up with a really excellent guy, Chris Emery from America, who's currently in Australia, and he's made the film about the Oklahoma bombings, which we played a snippet from last week, and I'm getting him on to discuss the Oklahoma bombing. So please bear with me, and we'll have Chris on imminently. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Well, at this point, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Chris Emery. Chris has, as I mentioned earlier, just arrived in Australia recently, and he's a film writer, director and producer, and has been living in Oklahoma City for a number of years. And he's working on his fifth documentary, which is now almost ready, and it's a feature-length film covering the Oklahoma City bombing case. His interest in the truth movement was spawned several years ago as he discovered a consistent pattern of lies and deception in the US government's official accounts of the shootout at Ruby Ridge, the World Trade Center 93, the Waco massacre, the OKC bombing, and the downing of TWA Flight 800 and the 9/11 fiasco. Chris has given several presentations around the US regarding the documented links between the Oklahoma bombing, 9/11, and other domestic and foreign false flag terrorist attacks. So, Chris, great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on the show, and it's definitely an honor to have the opportunity to live here in Sydney, a beautiful city.
It is, isn't it? And, we've hooked up a couple of times now, and you've been just exploring Sydney, and you're planning to spend a bit of time here as you finish the film. A lot of our listeners may not be very aware of the details of the Oklahoma bombing. And in fact, I'm actually not. I mean, you know, it was that long ago at a time when sort of terrorism wasn't the constant thing in the news that it is now. And I guess it must have been really interesting for you to actually, you know, in the wake of 9/11 and all the subsequent information we've had, to go back and have a look at the Oklahoma bombing. It must have been a really interesting journey.
It was. In fact, I started looking into the case actually in January of 2000, a full year and 9 months before 9/11 even occurred. And I stumbled across it by way of a colleague of mine that I had met when I was living in Fort Worth, Texas, which is just on the west side of the Dallas Metroplex. And Oklahoma City, as the crow flies, is about a 3.5-hour drive due north on Interstate 35, which goes all the way from Laredo, Texas, up to Minneapolis into the Canadian border. So, and Austin is 3.5 hours south of Dallas-Fort Worth, and Oklahoma City is about 3.5 hours due north. I made 14 trips, round trips, between Fort Worth and Oklahoma City to start my research on the film,
right.
Interviewing, as of the last count, as of about 6 months ago, over 329 victims, family members, and survivors, just to get a true and accurate and precise accounting of what actually occurred that morning. It was on April 19, 1995, as most of your listeners are probably aware, a Wednesday morning, and the horrific series of explosions emanated from the Murrah Building at 9.02 a.m. So everybody was already in their offices, pretty much settled in for the day. And what occurred from then on, right through, here we are almost 16 years, this April has just been a watershed of information coming forward, a life-changing experience for me and about 35 of my colleagues that are still in Oklahoma City and around the United States that are helping out with the film.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and so where were you at the time of the Oklahoma bombing, Chris? Which part of the country were you in?
I was actually living in Austin, Texas, and I remember, you know, as they say, you know, life is, you don't remember days, you remember moments, and I was actually working for my dad. His office was in central Austin, a beautiful part of the city, and I remember going into the break room that morning, and a couple of his secretaries were doing their 9 o'clock coffee break, and catching up on the events from the day before, and the little black and white TV was on in the break room, and I remember making the corner, coming in and looking down, and I thought, oh my gosh, what in the world took place? Literally a third of the Murrah Building just launched from where it stood to the north. It took off as though some alien craft just literally sucked in and displaced it around the three or four blocks just north of where it stood in downtown Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
And the secretaries were crying, and I it took me a few minutes to realize that this was amazing. It was really sad to see that.
Sure.
I remember that moment very clearly.
Just looking here at the Wikipedia article on Oklahoma, the Oklahoma bombing, looking at the photograph there, you can see the entire front of the building was just basically taken off, probably quite a long way into the building as well. It looks as if it's just basically sort of almost vaporized or just totally destroyed. Anyway, I'd imagine, what was the total death toll? It was 160 something?
It was 169 people, including three unborns. Five of those 169 victims were actually outside of the building, traversing down the sidewalk in between their errands in the morning, some coming out of the vehicle, some leaving the building. One of them was actually in a building across the street on the second level. It was called the Water Resources Building. That particular building is an ominous spot in history because it was the site of where there was in Oklahoma, they have water rights. Of course, you know, when you drill for water, you have to make sure that it's all legal and everything. There was a hearing going on in that building, and there was a tape recorder running on the table, a cassette tape recorder.
Right.
And that is the only known recording of the actual explosions, a series of explosions coming out of the Murrah Building. The FBI quickly confiscated it and dubbed the tape over many times to make it sound like a single explosion. Forensic and audio experts that I've consulted with listened to the official, as released by the Department of Justice, recording, and they said, yeah, this thing was dubbed over many times. So that's where the only known recording of the explosion came from, was from that building.
Right. And so your research indicates that there's more than one explosion. And what's hard to believe from looking at the visual evidence is that this was just the result of a bomb in a parked pickup truck, which is the official story, that it could basically do such sort of asymmetrical damage in a way, because I mean, we can see that the Murrah Building was destroyed, but what about the environs around the explosion? If it was in the pickup truck, it should have been an equal blast in all directions.
Exactly, and you brought up a very good point. In fact,
yeah.
Early news accounts, and you can go on YouTube and type in Oklahoma City bombing news accounts, and I've talked to some of the reporters that have since retired and relocated out of the area, one of them being, oddly enough, with an NBC affiliate in Detroit, also with Channel 4, and he came from Channel 4 NBC in Oklahoma City. His name is Devin Skillian.
Sure.
We had lunch about 2 years ago, and he told me what had happened that morning in his account of the news, the wire stories, and how they changed within a matter of about 4 hours. But to answer your question,
yeah,
those news stories started out with a car loaded with ANFO, then it escalated to a pickup, like you mentioned, then it escalated to a Ryder truck.
Okay,
now,
yeah.
All of them being, you could cherry pick it straight out of a fantasy or a child storybook. It was just complete garbage. What had really happened and what we found out, and this is a culmination of actually looking at the video tapes, the official tapes shot by the Oklahoma City Police Department helicopters, Oklahoma County Sheriff helicopters within 10 minutes, was that there were at least four explosions that came from the inside of the building and launched out to the north. The gouge that most people see from a lot of the news clips was actually facing to the north, and then the shot was taken facing to the south. The Ryder truck, in the whole scheme of things, Arrowhead was simply an afterthought, because we have 14 survivors from the building, 14 employees,
yeah,
that actually had the wherewithal and the cognitive ability to dive under their desks, knowing that the building was shaking as a sensation of a earthquake,
right,
which clearly shows that there was controlled demolition devices in the building, and we found that to be true.
Okay.
The blueprints that we were able to get from confidential sources with the GSA out of Fort Worth show that column 47, which is called A47, was the key column that collapsed. There were at least 6 feet of that column completely gone. It turned instantly into chalk dust, which was dissembled at the snap of a finger. That is not a result of a blast wave attenuation coming from a Ryder truck allegedly parked on the street 47 feet away. It was definitely without doubt, resolute contact charge on that column. And there were unexploded ordnances on three other columns, two others, and then one other was completely destroyed. And then, of course, ordnance found on the west side and on the east side of the building that was timed to go off 10 minutes after the initial blast. So this whole, hokum and pokum story from the Department of Justice not only is completely ridiculous, it's a slap in the face to the victims, family members, and survivors. And the whole point of this movie is to bring out the real accounting of what had happened, and that's what we're going to try to do in a professional, respectful manner.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And, of course, it appears that by presenting Timothy McVeigh as the killer, it seems to be a very common tactic for this type of operation when they want to pin it on an individual to then use it for a political purpose. Now, I'm just reading from Wikipedia here, and Wikipedia is always a good touchstone for what the mainstream official view of any subject is. And as we know, Wikipedia is massively interfered with by teams of people. And
sure.
We know from Australia that, in fact, large numbers of people from the Defence Department in Australia have edited the Wikipedia articles on the 9/11 events, for example. Very interesting.
Okay.
But so always take Wikipedia with a large pinch of salt. But so here it says, motivated by his hatred of the federal government and angered by what he perceived to be as its mishandling of the Waco siege and the Ruby Ridge incident, McVeigh timed his attack to coincide with the second anniversary of the deaths at Waco. Within 90 minutes of the explosion, McVeigh was stopped by a state trooper for driving without a license plate and arrested for unlawfully carrying a weapon. Well, gee, that was convenient, isn't it, that he was driving without a license plate? He must have been pretty stupid.
He actually had one gentleman in the car with him within seconds before the multiple explosions came out of the building, and that is corroborated by at least three eyewitnesses, one of them that they almost ran over in an alley no more than 230 feet to the north of the building. It's very interesting. Would the film crew tour, and if you ever have an opportunity to come to Oklahoma City, when I go back there to do the premiere, I'd love to give you a tour of it. It actually, the crime scene is about 4 miles versus the two or three blocks that CNN and
right.
the network stations chose to broadcast on TV. But as far as McVeigh and getting back to your question and statement, McVeigh had the help of at least 12, if not 18 individuals. And of course, Terry Nichols had a very, very minor part in the whole scheme. Terry Nichols was 230 miles away, putting a roof on his house in Harrington, Kansas, when the bombing happened.
Sure.
And so that's, that whole thing was just complete cock and bull there, too. But to answer your question, McVeigh was actually on the payroll of the government at the time. He was working for the CIA. So this is textbook CIA. There's the good side and the bad side of the CIA, and just with any government agency, I don't care what country you're talking about. And it was a complete breakdown of communication. McVeigh was actually playing both sides, both working for the CIA as well as working for some of the entities that had a vested interest in making sure that building was blown up. It's very shocking and very sobering to see who actually wanted that building taken down.
Sure.
As far as the militia and the official stock story and the Wikipedia article and many others, it just doesn't add up. In fact, the militia would have been guarding the building. I mean, that's where they cash their paychecks for Pete's sake. There's no reason for them to blow up the building.
Yeah, it seemed so illogical at the time. I remember even thinking that, you know, like, why would they attack a building like that, you know, with a kindergarten full of little children? I just, you know.
It makes no sense whatsoever. And what we found out, and you know, usually in the heat of the moment, and as you're aware, in many disasters, whether it be this or the Port Arthur cases we had talked about earlier this
Indeed.
Week over dinner, is that the facts bear out within the first 2 or 3 hours after the event. And then if the government agencies or whomever want to come in and change it, that's their prerogative. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to believe the official story. So the whole approach on the film is that we took basically starting from even before the bombing happened, what was going on? You know, who planned this thing? Who committed it and who decided to cover it up? The three phases that we're going to cover. Once again, McVeigh was helped. There were at least 12 people involved with this, as many as 18. Out of those 18, there were we know of at least 4 that were on the payroll of the government, including McVeigh. Some of them were informants. Some of them tried to act and pass along the intelligence that they had up to about 2.5 to 3 months before the bombing happened. The FBI, the CIA, and the ATF completely ignored. And to compound the situation, what made it even worse was that those agencies weren't communicating with each other. It was a complete wholesale breakdown in communication, just horrific. Egos, turf wars, you name it. And the same thing played out exactly in 9/11. And, you know, they say grown men don't cry, but when I saw 9/11 happen, I says, my God, this is just exponentially the same script, just worse than what happened in Oklahoma City. They didn't learn the lesson.
Yeah.
And that's why that played out the way it did.
So, Chris, is there a motive then for demolishing the building? You were hinting at that before. What was there? Was there information in there? Was there documents in there that were going to be a problem to someone?
There was actually one federal case that was due to go to court in May of 95, approximately 3.5 to 4 weeks after the bombing occurred. Huge federal drug smuggling case. Oklahoma City being on the conduit of Interstate 35 was a prime stop-off point for many drug smugglers. Dallas and Fort Worth and Oklahoma City were the prime areas because they all points in between the east and west coast, as well as north and south, major interstate arteries running through those federal highways running through the cities. Long story short, the evidence for that federal drug case was stored on, from the best of our knowledge, on the seventh floor. It was a double setup safe room on the seventh floor for the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. All of that was completely destroyed. And I found this out from a third party that actually lived across the street from one of the main culprits that was indicted in that case. And he walked scot-free because the federal government literally had nothing to go on.
Right.
Everything was destroyed in the building. And they had to drop all charges, and he walked away. So that was very interesting. That's just one setup. And then, of course, we know that some of the components in the building were actually supplied by overseas terrorist organizations. So for anybody, after they look at the facts and, you know, even a 1 or 2 hour peruse of what we're looking at, still thinks that McVeigh and Nichols did this. And I'm quoting this out of the mouth of a former terrorist from Madison, Wisconsin, that did a almost identical scale case back in August of 1970. He looked at me and he says, there's no way that McVeigh and Nichols physically, financially, or mentally could have pulled this off by themselves. He said it would have been impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems totally improbable that something like that can be done. I mean, because it comes down to the physical evidence, you know. I mean, if it's possible to just, you know, load up a Ryder truck with fertilizer and just, you know, park it outside a building and do that sort of damage, then I guess it is possible. I mean, have you looked at other explosions that have occurred? I remember there was one in Pakistan a couple of years ago, which they said like it had been a truck outside the hotel. Do you remember that one? It was a massive explosion. But I
vaguely remember, but there was, and I know what you're getting at. That's exactly, it's a spot on good point, the question that you posed.
Yeah.
Before I decided to take this case on, one of my colleagues in Fort Worth said, look, he says, Chris, you have to get bookend cases, basically what happened before and what happened after, to get a good reference to make sure that you're standing on solid ground and your findings. So I went back to Bogota, Colombia. I believe it was in 1994. There was almost an identical case where a building was blown out, and it was an ANFO. They found that there was interior ordnance, and it was claimed to be ANFO. The State Department and the CIA were touting this completely ridiculous story, and they come to find out that it wasn't true at all. And then, there were other cases across the Kenya bombing, same thing. I mean, it was telltale that there was interior ordnance in those buildings.
Oh, that's interesting. So this has happened in multiple situations where there's been a bomb outside plus explosives inside.
Right. And the whole reason for the Ryder truck, they were actually, the official record, there were 23 Ryder trucks rented that day.
Right.
Identical size in Oklahoma City. People were moving. It was the middle of the month.
Yeah.
You know, just at random, they were rentals. So we found from eyewitnesses that there were actually, to the best of our knowledge, at the very least, there were two teams running this operation. One is the decoy, and one actually pulled the deed off. And there were electronic timers on the explosives that were mounted on the columns, no doubt about it. The cruel irony to this, in the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum, which is actually in the Journal Record Building, 240 feet due north of where the Murrah Building stands, and is still to this day, if you were to walk in there, has physical evidence, which completely contradicts the official story. For some reason, their staff or members of their staff and the executive director chose not to vet the correct information on that. So they're literally showing information that contradicts the Department of Justice and the FBI story. One of them being a photo, huge blow-up photo of the rebar in one of the main columns that was destroyed, which was flashpoint. They were bent like pretzel sticks. It doesn't happen on air blast attenuation coming from an alleged Ryder truck 47 feet away.
Right.
In order to do that, you have to have contact charges. And this is coming from military experts that did this. I mean, that was they were tasked to design ordnance to do exactly that around the world, the different military and theaters and battles. One of them being General Ben Parton, who was the head of the Pentagon Armament Lab for 18 years. He was the expert's expert. And when he looked at those photos, he says, my gosh, you know, it would be sad, if not so much disappointing, when you look at this, to say these people simply didn't get their information straight, and they choose to pander the lie to this day. So the physical evidence is there. The photos are there. The videos are there.
Yeah.
Everything that was taken within a half an hour to 45 minutes from the aerial helicopters clearly shows that there was ordnance in the building. I mean, it's not even up for debate anymore. It's a proven fact.
There's multiple different pieces of evidence that basically indicate that. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And the physical evidence is still in the museum. I can bring in any forensic expert, and they'll say, yeah, this is pretty much what happened, and it blew it from the inside out.
Right. And it says here in Wikipedia that there was it was ammonium nitrate fertilizer bomb. Now that sounds familiar, because I believe that Bali bombing was claimed to be a similar type of bomb, and I know some people who've done research into that, and there's actually a question about the overpressure that you can get with those type of bombs, say compared to military grade explosives. And in the case of the Bali bombing, what we had was concrete actually stripped from rebar, so that all the concrete was actually stripped off. And apparently, again, that's another indication that it cannot be this type of bomb, because
exactly.
It doesn't generate enough overpressure.
In fact, General Parton, I had the opportunity to fly to his home in Alexandria, Virginia, in October of 2003. And we had dinner and talked about many things, including the TWA case. And maybe we can allude to that in another interview.
Yeah, sure.
I turned over the notes to the film crew before I moved over here to Sydney. I says, guys, this is the expert's own handwriting. And he scribbled out seven pages on large legal pad sheets of what had happened in Oklahoma City. And he told me, he says, you can pull a semi-truck trailer 52 feet long, under pristine lab conditions, which certainly didn't exist on the morning of the bombing. It was just 42 degrees Fahrenheit, a 41-mile-an-hour headwind.
Sure.
Humidity was pretty high. I'm just completely against anything that would promote a perfect explosion of Anvil. Anyway, he says, even if he had pristine lab conditions, 52-foot trailer full of this stuff, he said it still wouldn't do the damage that occurred in the Murrah building.
Mm.
And he says, because the explosion emanated in the opposite direction, you're looking at 180-degree point source difference. So you look at the photos, you look at the eyewitnesses, what they experienced minutes and seconds before the bombing even happened. Let me give you a quick review. For a full 5 to 8 seconds before the truck bomb even detonated, the Murrah building was coming down from east to west direction. And the photos show it. The eyewitness accounts show it. The unexploded ordnance where it was mounted proves that. In the whole scheme of things, once again, the Ryder truck was simply an afterthought. It was a false flag. It was simply a shock and awe. And it had very little to do with the destruction of the building.
But there was an explosion there, so that just gave them that...
If anything, it ruptured the hearing and it caused severe hearing problems to what we know, 29 people within the area. Some of them were still in bed in an apartment building less than a block and a half away. But other than that, it did very little to contribute to the damage of the building.
Sure. Chris, we're just going to take a really quick break and just get back into some of the bigger picture questions about this whole event. Here's a song by Bob Dylan. It's called Seven Curses, and it's from the Bootleg albums.
O'Reilly stole a stallion, but they caught him and they brought him back, and they laid him down in the jailhouse ground with an iron chain around his neck. When Riley's daughter got a message that her father was going to hang, she rode by night and came by morning with gold and silver in her hand. When the judge saw Riley's daughter, his old eyes deepened in his head, saying, "Gold will never free your father. The price, my dear, is you instead." "Oh, I'm as good as dead," cried Riley. "It's only you that he does crave. And my skin will surely crawl if it touches you at all. Get on your horse and ride away." "Oh, father, you will surely die if I don't take the chance to try and pay the price and not take your advice. For that reason, I will have to stay." The gallows shadows shook the evening, in the night a hound dog bayed, in the night the grounds was groaning, in the night the price was paid. The next morning she had awoken to find that the judge had never spoken. She saw that hanging branch abandoned. She saw her father's body broken. These be seven curses on a judge so cruel that one doctor cannot save him. That two healers cannot heal him, and the three eyes cannot see him. That four ears cannot hear him, that five walls cannot hide him, that six daggers cannot buy him, And at seven deaths, she'll never kill him.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Peace. We have voices.
Welcome back to Truth News. Today I'm interviewing Chris Emery, filmmaker and a person with a great passion to find the truth about many things, including the Oklahoma bombing, which is the topic of Chris's latest film. Chris, I didn't get the title of your film. I would have introduced it properly with the title, but I seem to have missed that. What is the title of your film?
The working title, as they say, it's we'll probably have it as a final title. It's called A Noble Lie, A, and then N-O-B-L-E, and then Lie, L-I-E. And that comes from a quote from Plato, where the masses or the citizens are given a lie just to maintain social order. And that was actually came from a brainstorm idea of one of my co-producers, James Lane, and Holland Van den Nieuwenhoff. Very appropriate.
Sure.
We have the trailer actually out on YouTube, and it has just over 6,000 hits. It was released on 9/11 in New York City at one of the venues up there and was received very well to an ovation. And it's, if you just simply YouTube the search A Noble Lie and then dash trailer, T-R-A-I-L-E-R, number one. It's the movie trailer. It's a 3-minute, 39-second preview of some of the highlights of the film. Just been an incredible and very rewarding and beautiful experience to be able to interview at least 25 people that we're going to have on there. The best of the best. This is the A-list of all of the folks that are experts on this, as well as survivors, victims, family members, and survivors. So we're very honored to have the opportunity to do that. And that trailer will give you an idea of what direction we're moving in.
Yeah, look, it sounds great. We actually put it on our show notes last week, and it looked really interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to see that when it comes out. I'm just wondering, would you be able to give a bit of historical background? I mean, I'm not sure how relevant you consider the Waco and Ruby Ridge to be to this. I mean, do you think this is actually, that those events are relevant to the Oklahoma bombing, or is it just being used as a cover story?
No, in fact, it's odd that is the thread of history that weaves in between all of these cases. Yeah, it's very relevant.
Yeah.
One of the first acts of terrorism actually in the United States was the massacre at Wounded Knee, and I believe you could correct me, it was in 1872, Wounded Knee.
I do remember that. I did read that book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, when I was a teenager.
I really had to go back and take a look at that as a filmmaker, and you have to get in a certain mindset to say, wow, you know, is it possible for certain elements of the United States government, not everyone, I mean, there's good people that
sure.
work for the government that actually are helping us with the film, local, county, state, and federal level, but to see the depth and the breadth of this. Anyway, I moved from that case, and then, of course, the false flag of Pearl Harbor and then the Gulf of Tonkin and the Vietnam War. Moving ahead to Ruby Ridge, it was a clear-cut case of just a breakdown in the rules of engagement. You don't walk on somebody's sovereign property and shoot the wife in the head and nearly kill the 3-year-old daughter in her arms and shoot the dog and the son because of some trumped-up charges on semi-automatic machine gun parts that he allegedly was manufacturing, which it was all legal. He was set up
right.
by an informant that was due to face some stiff prison time for drug smuggling. Anyway, I looked at Ruby Ridge, and there were two teams. There were two SWAT teams that were there. One was from Denver, and the other was brought in from Philadelphia. The Denver SWAT team knew that there was the incorrect rules of engagement. They stood down. They said, there's no way we're gonna shoot Mr. Weaver and his family. They walked away. It was the Philadelphia SWAT team that came in and did it. And Lon Herucci was the gentleman that shot Randy Reeve's wife.
Yeah.
Long story short there, he ended up getting off on all charges. In fact, one of it was given a cash award by the court of over $1.1 million.
Really?
That's not a handout. The government didn't give that to him by choice. They were forced to do that because they completely screwed up. You move ahead to Waco, And I had the opportunity to drive the route. Oh, gosh, it was very heartening. And here again, I shed a few tears driving from Waco out to the Mount Carmel compound in August of 05.
Yeah.
Just to see, first of all, the distance of the military material that had to go from Fort Hood to the Mount Carmel compound. You don't do that in just a whim. You don't make a few phone calls. It took several days, if not a week, to get all that out there. It was a concerted effort to completely, how do we say this? They took away all the rights of the people out there. There was no reason for them to shoot them and to entrap them like that.
It was really a military siege like they do in Iraq or something. It was like
that. Horrible. I mean, they had Bradley armored vehicles. They had helicopter gunships. They had the mind control and sound cannons, everything out there. It was terrible. There was no way. I'm surprised that there are any survivors. Come to find out that they could have gone in there and knocked on the door of the compound any day of the week. McClellan County Sheriff knew David Koresh. He saw him jogging out on the road every day. It was a completely over-the-top, a trumped-up military exercise that went wrong.
Right.
And the shots were called, the commands were called from Janet Reno's office in the White House. Horrible. Habeas corpus was completely thrown out. Posse comitatus was completely ignored, which prevents the military from taking action against private citizens. Completely ignored. And it was General Wesley Clark who actually oversaw that. He had the gall to run for the United States president in 2004. They're just an interesting cast of characters. Okay, so that set the precedent. We found out from a former head of the ATF, meaning myself and my colleagues, that it was a trial that was connected to Oklahoma City by the name of Carol Howe. She was brought up on trumped-up charges in Tulsa about the same time that McVeigh's trial was going on in Denver. The second in command of the ATF said that the reason Oklahoma City happened was that the ATF wanted to try to remunerate themselves. Once again, stage a Hollywood type of tack just to say, hey, we came in and we stopped this thing right before it happened. It didn't occur that way. So those two cases were definitely entwined. Oklahoma City was meant to try to save face for the ATF. Not only did they didn't do that, it just compounded it. It actually exacerbated the situation. It went worse. It made them look worse. And so to answer your question, yes, they were definitely tied in very close.
And would Timothy McVeigh, I mean, was Timothy McVeigh really inspired by this? I imagine that there was some truth to that. Was he actually, is there evidence that he was actually very upset over those events?
Well, you know, to this day, we really don't know for sure because he's dead.
You know,
there were certain people. In fact, two of the survivors tried to sue for that, and that's a whole other story we can pursue another time. But he was killed within 4 years, which is unheard of when you're on death row. Normally it stretches out for 11 to 14 years.
That is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah,
4 years.
What we have is McVeigh was seen there, and video was shot of him handing out bumper stickers at the Waco siege behind what they call the media line. Media couldn't get within a mile to a mile and a half of Mount Carmel. So he was cited there as, you know, handing out bumper stickers, certainly not getting radical or anything. And that was, I believe, for less than 2 days. Other than that, we have no solid concrete evidence of him actually being upset about it. There were no letters that were written to his family citing Waco. The only thing he cited in the letters he was writing to his family was the fact that he was working for the CIA, that he was undercover, that he was so deep cover. The FBI had no idea where he was for at least 3.5 to 4 months.
Right.
Now, when
right.
the FBI can't find you, that means that you're definitely off the record, you're off the charts, and you're working for somebody that wants to make sure that you can't be found. So that is fact. We know that to be true. But as far as the Waco thing, that's just poppycock. It's just something else that the mainstream media was grasping at, and they threw out there. Hopefully, somebody would believe it.
And sort of in retrospect, it looks like it's all related and. You know, one thing that I find with these type of false flag events, and it makes it really hard for the average person to actually understand it, when you've got a lot of different outcomes and benefits on different levels.
Sure.
And like we saw that with 9/11, we see it's not just who benefits, it's all different types of people benefiting. And sometimes it's like a criminal cabal comes together to commit an act that has outcomes that support these criminal people in a variety of different ways. I mean, you're talking here about some information about a drug bust. You're talking about some sort of operation, perhaps to demonize the militias.
Exactly.
You're talking about a false flag sort of methodology, which has been used in other cases, but with also some very specific reasons why they might have wanted to destroy that building. Is that the kind of picture that you're painting of it, that it all came together at that one point?
Yes, you're spot on with that, Herwood. We have a flowchart that was put together by one of the gentlemen that's actually in the film. His name is W. Craig Roberts. He's a former investigator with the Tulsa Police Department. The relevance of Mr. Roberts and all of this is he was actually handpicked within 48 hours. He was called by the FBI field office in Tulsa to help research this case. Every single step that he took, and I believe he was on the case for 6 months, he was finding that the FBI either purposely or accidentally unintentionally started lying to him and giving him false intel. And after that six-month period, he says, guys, I'm off the case. I can't work with you. You're not giving me the right information here, and you're just flat-out lying to me.
Right.
But to answer your question, yes, he was finding that there were actually a lot of different parties involved in this. Some knew of others, and some of it was so compartmentalized, they didn't know of each other. It's just a very catastrophic set of circumstances where you have the legislation. There was no anti-terrorism legislation required. There was enough already in the U.S. Constitution. It didn't need to be added on. It was a pile-on.
Yeah.
It was the Clinton administration and certain individuals in there that wanted the gun rights of the United States citizens taken away. This was a roundabout way for them to get to that end game. It didn't work. It backfired. To this day, we still have the Second Amendment in place in the United States, and are very proud of it.
Yeah.
So that was a complete waste there. And then, of course, the drug case. There's some talk out there that the documents from the Whitewater investigation, the Clinton family, and their mingling in complete corruption and land swap and banking deals, that would have taken them down. Their political career would have been finished within a matter of weeks.
Sure.
Those hearings were due to set out in almost the same time as a federal drug case.
And they were going to be held in the Oklahoma courthouse, were they?
There is statements made that they were in the Murrah building. We don't have that as solid fact, but by virtue of the fact that Oklahoma City was farther away from... Bill Clinton was from Arkansas. You can't have the records of an indicted case like that in the same state. So they had to ship them to the nearest federal courthouse, the federal building. And Oklahoma City, by default, by geographic location, was that. Dallas would have been too far away. Oklahoma City was close, as New Orleans was too far away. So there were documents in there that were very sensitive. In fact, so sensitive. We know this by the fire department personnel and some of the law enforcement that were trying to get out the survivors that evening of the bombing. The FBI came in and called them off the crime scene for two hours to get documents out of the building. They had no compunction. They had no care about people screaming and bleeding to death under the rubble.
Right.
They wanted those documents. They walked off, completely ignoring the whoever was still surviving and the dead. They're walking over the dead through the rubble. So we know that the FBI was there on a mission to get those documents out. Unfortunately, we don't know for sure what those documents were.
Extraordinary. Now, Chris, I remember reading at one point in my 9/11 research that some of the – I know there was an official investigation of the bombing, and some of the members of the team seemed to pop up again in some of the 9/11 investigations. Did you come across this?
As far as you mean the perpetrators, the alleged perpetrators for 9/11?
I'm actually talking about the people who are in the government investigation teams.
Dr. Crowley. It was called the BPAT team, or technical experts that were brought in to analyze what had happened at the crime scene, write an official report for FEMA.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yes, some of their heads, they reared their ugly heads again, and for not only the World Trade Center case, but for Pentagon. Of course, there wasn't anything to investigate in the Shanksville United 93 case, because that plane was shot down 8.5 miles away. And that's since come out as being bona fide and verified by George Bush in his memoirs. So we know that whole thing was a lie.
Well, yeah, he said he thought it was shut down, didn't he?
Yeah. It was A-10 Warthog. It was a NATO plane, different tail numbers. Actually, it was dispatched out of North Carolina. That plane shot down United 93.
Mm.
Here again, that's another conversation for another time.
Absolutely.
I have a bone to pick with a colleague of mine, Paul Greengrass, who actually produced that movie. For him to give and to be having a complete crap screenplay and then spend $22 million of somebody else's money to come up with a story that makes no sense.
Oh, is that the United 93 movie?
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was the worst piece of work that anybody could have ever done. But anyway, for somebody that produced all three of the Bourne Identity movies, did a stellar job there, and then to have that come out under his name, I wouldn't have want my name on any part, even as a production assistant on that movie. That's how bad it was. But anyway, getting back to your question, yes. In fact, Oklahoma City was so over the top as far as incompetence on that FEMA report. Let me give you an idea of what these guys were not allowed within 250 feet from the crime scene.
Really?
They weren't given actual rubble and samples from the destroyed columns. They were given shop drawings. They were told from the FBI what to put in the report, and they were told to walk away. Now, there's no objectivity there. It's complete rig. Yeah. All of this information, as they say, it's garbage in, garbage out. If you want good information, you have to have independent analysis. That team in Oklahoma City, I know for a fact, just by virtue of what they did and what they said in their report and how they came across their information, had no objectivity. It was spoon-fed to them by the Department of Justice and the FBI. Case closed. It was horrible.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, there's just over and over again we see this betrayal, this kind of undermining of things like science, you know, investigation, forensics. It goes back, doesn't it? I mean, you know, we're in a kind of a crisis when every time there's some major incident, crime, you know, international event, when it gets investigated, we find political people deciding what the scientific findings should be, and if the scientists or researchers don't agree, well, they're told to just go away, and you know they selectively choose who's actually going to look at the evidence, and I mean this is a real crisis for our civilization because you can't do that and have a stable society. I mean, it's
exactly.
Just...
Exactly. And, you know, even when we were talking at dinner earlier this week, Herwood, you look at the cases that happened after Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
You've got the Omagh bombing. It's O-M-A-G-H in Northern Ireland in August of 95. Almost a carbon copy of what happened in Oklahoma City, except it was set up by the MI5 and British intelligence to get people in there. It was horrible. I believe 82 or 83 people... 89 people were killed in that. I have the book on that. And a colleague of mine had a great interview with one of the victims' family members that survived that whole ordeal, and they're demanding the truth to come out. Then you have, of course, the Port Arthur massacre in April 29th of 1996.
Yeah, we discussed that a few days ago. Yeah.
That is ridiculous for the set of answers and the results coming from that. I mean, you know, not. If you wonder which worse, the arrogance or the fact that the authorities are so over the top that they think we're stupid enough to believe what they're telling us. We're not. They're insulting our intelligence. So you have to sit up straight and pay attention and ask, okay, we know they're lying to us. I mean, that's not even up for debate. Why are they lying to us?
Yeah.
Well, they took away a lot of the gun rights, from what I understand, here in Oklahoma, Australia.
Yeah,
right
the changes
fast forward the tape to July of 96.
Yeah.
And it was within days of the Atlanta Olympics starting in the United States. And the accidental shootdown of TWA Flight 800 by the United States Navy off the coast of Long Island. Horrific cover-up there. It just doesn't end. Then the Kenya bombings were lied about. And then, of course, 9/11. So it's a consistent pattern. The body count continues to climb through all of these events. And it's the end result is they want to take away our rights. They want to give an alleged group of boogeymen that simply don't exist to, whether it be to support a war that's supposed to go on for 10 years or take away your gun rights. People have to realize when these things happen, immediately take note of why it happened and why we're being lied to.
Yeah, and speaking of boogeymen, one of the things they like to do sort of in between the major events is to have little scares that are actually just nothing.
Sure.
But then there's one on the news today, and we were just covering it earlier in the show, and which is just a classic kind of behavioral reinforcement with this scare of some, you know, explosive materials being mailed from Yemen. Have you picked that up on the news yet?
I haven't picked it up yet.
Oh, look, it's all over the news at the moment. They're repeating it. Like, I listened to the news for a while, and like it came on like 10 times in an hour. And it's going to be one of those news stories that goes around the world and dominates for about a week. But it's going to have zero facts behind it. But
sure.
President Obama himself has already gone on television talking about it, saying how terrible it is, when in fact nothing happened. You know, right. some letters were sent apparently from Yemen to some Jewish synagogues, and they said they found explosive materials in them. But this pattern, what I find is that we have real attacks where people are actually killed. We have pseudo attacks more and more. It seems that a lot of what is done is actually just reinforcing the fear, just letting you know that the boogeyman is out there. And like we saw that with the underpants bomber last year, where and you know, I think that when you look at the pattern, you see that there is actually something going on here. Something is actually being orchestrated scientifically to keep the population just that little bit afraid all the time, to make it easier for the government to hand over their power to the government. And we've seen it gradually over time, and over time it's become worse and worse, and it's really getting bad now. But it has been quite gradual.
You're so true on that, and you always go back to, okay, who has a vested interest in making sure this happens? You have, you know, the military industrial complex, okay, to a certain extent, but it's the intelligence agencies that need to verify, they need to basically make their existence worthwhile. They have to have some type of a substance, whether it be true or false, just to say, okay, we're going to get funding next year, we have to have so many cases that come up. Some people say, oh, come on, you know, it's simple. No, it really is that simple. And yeah, we've seen it happen. That's why what happened in Oklahoma City. The ATF was going to get their funding completely cut. They were going to be eliminated within about 4 weeks after that case occurred, because they simply didn't need to exist anymore. It was an overlap. It was bureaucracy. So, but getting back to, I think our train of thought was, okay, why are these things happening? Why are we being lied to? And then the other flip side of this is when you try to get the truth out on them, and I've had this happen to me, and some of the political leaders and economic leaders in Oklahoma City, they'll come up to me at a dinner function, or I may be out in public shopping or whatever, and they look at me, and they know who I am, and I know who they are, and they say, you know, how dare you ask questions? How dare you do this movie? And I look at them straight in the face, and I say, you know what? I sleep well at night knowing the fact that I'm trying to remember the deaths of the victims in Oklahoma City and the truth versus a lie. I says, what are you doing? And they walk away. I mean, that's what it is. Do you want to remember the death and the truth, or do you want to remember it in a lie? And if they're uncomfortable with trying to uncover the truth, that's their problem, not mine. Our film crew is going to do the best we can to make sure that this is done in a correct and respectful fashion. And we're very, very honored to have that opportunity.
Yeah, great. And, you know, look, it's a similar reason why I do Truth News as well, you know, because I feel I need to sleep at night as well, and I feel like I need to do something, and I wish it was more. I wish I could have more impact. And you know, the people I know that are involved in, you know, truth and justice of any kind, any type of activities, just they're just driven to it by that. And I remember speaking to Niels Harrit, who's the co-author of the paper that studied the World Trade Center nanothermite.
He's done a superb job. I have a lot of respect for him. He's great.
Yeah, and we had dinner with him when he was here in Sydney, and he basically said, look, when I discovered this reality, he said, I was either going to live in shame or I was going to become an activist. You know, it was a stark choice, because once you know, if you don't do something about it, you're sort of living in a personal shame.
Exactly.
And that's why all the people who are researching things, and it's great when people, you know, investigate something very specific like what you've done. And, you know, we were talking about Port Arthur last time we met, and that's a subject which I think really needs to be explored in Australia.
I would love to have the opportunity to research that. We just have to get the funding and the infrastructure together. Some of my colleagues in the United States I know would definitely jump at the opportunity. And I'd love to bring you on board, but that's a little ways down the road.
We've got to get this one out of the way first.
But it's definitely worth a thorough review, and I know that there will be more good coming out of that than bad. There will be some that will be stomping and screaming and acting indignant, not wanting us to touch it, but I know there will be more people that will say, please, just find out what happened. And 99% of that support will actually come from the victims' family members and some of the survivors, because people inherently are very smart. And that's what we're doing with this film, is we're gonna actually play with their intelligence. We're not going to insult it. Play in a good way. I mean that. But basically say, look, you're smart enough to see through this. Please make a decision, and then, you know, take action accordingly if you choose to do so.
Yeah, no, that's the way to go. So what is the release date? Do you have a release date yet?
Originally it was in January. We had to bump it up for logistics and some technical reasons, we're going to actually go HD on this and want to actually upgrade the quality of the film.
Right.
So we're shooting for just before the 16th year anniversary, which would be April 19 of next year.
Okay.
And I'm going to make arrangements to go back over to the U.S. to help with the premiere. We've got six cities already earmarked to premiere the show, the first being in Oklahoma City, and then down in Austin with Alex Jones at the there's a venue down there that is a favorite of his, and we're very honored to have him help us distribute the film. We did an excellent interview with him. He'll be in the film, and he's actually going to help us distribute. We have another colleague in Chicago that is going to help us there, and in Seattle, and I believe Atlanta and New York City want us to do a premiere, so we have to figure out how to make that all work. It'll be a handful just on logistics there, so we're excited.
Yeah, great. Well, look, please keep us updated on progress. Is there a website for the film at this point?
It's basically Free Mind Films. If you Google Free Mind Films, and it's basically Free Mind Report, which is the radio show that used to be Radio Free Oklahoma, and Free Mind Films button is on the Free Mind Report radio show. Also, by the way, I did want to mention we're looking forward to doing the premiere here in Sydney, too.
Great, yeah. We'll definitely be involved in that. That sounds awesome.
To have you and John Bursell and several others take part in that. We're very proud to have the opportunity to do that here.
Yeah, excellent. Well, look, I probably need to wind up, Chris. Really interesting dialogue there. There's so much to learn. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to spend the time I need to find out everything about this stuff. And to have someone like you putting a film together that just helps us get the salient points is vital. And, you know, we've actually shown a lot of films here in Sydney. I've been involved in actually screening films, documentaries that will never get shown in theatres because, you know, they're basically just censored.
Sure.
And there are so many great documentaries being made, and it's an honour to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. And hopefully we'll be able to sway individuals such as John Fain from, I believe it was Triple J, and it was just amazing how he excoriated Mr. Bracken. And Mr. Bracken was in the right.
I give my
full support behind Kevin to ask relevant questions.
Absolutely.
And, you know, with Ms. Gillard, the Prime Minister, making her comments this week, our effort is not to make those people look bad. It's just to say, please, you know, you're intelligent enough to see as a grown adult, as a mature adult. If you choose to remember a lie, that's your prerogative, but don't, you know, force us to try to do the same.
Absolutely.
And that's the whole point of this movie. We want to bring the truth out.
Yeah, and just on the Kevin Bracken affair, I've just heard today that he was on the Alex Jones show yesterday.
Yes.
So that will be an interesting listen.
That is awesome. I'm going to go in the archive and listen to that. So thank you for having me on, Harrowhead. It's been an honor, and I look forward to doing it again sometime.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Chris. Talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. That was quite an interesting journey there, disturbing as always, as we do on this show. We disturb, but we make you go back and have another look at things in history, and we try to piece it together, which is actually really hard. I mean, I don't understand the full picture. I don't know what the full agenda is, but I'm working on finding out. So on that note, I'll say good day to you. It's on this Saturday, the 30th of October, and look forward to your company next week. Over and out from Truth News Radio Australia.